Hi everybody, welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Now, Penny Bernard is my guest this week. Penny gets to wallow in heritage and nostalgia for a living. It's part of her job, translating archaeology for school audiences. And we discover that one silver lining in what has been a challenging year for everybody is that Penny has been able to follow her dream. She's gone to art college. We also learn about her family Tudor dinner party and how she finds that children are better at following the COVID guidelines than adults. Penny talks about how her family defines itself by its myths and histories, but she explains why this can be suffocating. She can trace her ancestry back to Somerset, and we learn that she was once kidnapped in Albania. Her earliest memory involves forget-me-nots and a traumatic memory involving wet hair, and she tells me why she thinks memory is an artful lie. Penny talks about what happened when she found her younger diaries and how myopic they could be. And she reflects on how there are dangers with relying on Facebook to tell us what we did in the past. Penny grew up in Bermuda and she loved being in the water. And she tells me about the reservations she has about going back as it might spoil her memories from the time. Now, the England that she returned to was not like the bed knobs and broomsticks or ladybird books that she was expecting. And she tells me why she hated Surrey and why she likes the notion of the glamorous outsider. We talk about her panto group and her motivations and passion for writing and performing every year, giving old fairy tales a new twist. Penny reveals that at school she played Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca, and we find out what she thinks about the latest Netflix version. Not really positive. We learn why Penny looks back on her time at St. Andrews, where she was a university student, with horror. And we find out about the nightmare she had the night before she met her husband, and why friends and family were convinced that Simon was the man she should marry. Penny talks about hypnotherapy and how it made her confront some unhappy memories for the first time, and how it is not possible to feel nostalgic about them, but that it is important to seize back the narrative. And at the very end of the interview, we learn that Penny has stayed in touch with people from school with whom she has shared trauma, and we learn why she is starting to look forward more than she used to, and why her greatest contribution to humanity, the toilets in Stonehenge. It was awesome to catch up with Penny for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Penny Bernard as my latest nostalgia interview guest. And of course, Penny, this is against the backdrop of another lockdown, turmoil in America, because by the time this goes out, maybe the world will all be back to its equilibrium. But it's so great to have you as my guest this week.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to have been invited.
And of course, we've known each other for many years. And one of the things I'm sure we're going to go on to later is the amazing work you do, both as a performer and a writer in pantomime. So it's almost pantomime season, except it's also, of course, not a conventional year. So how has 2020 been for you?
It's been a mixed bag, actually. We probably had it. My husband and had probably had COVID at the beginning of March, and we were both very, very ill. And he still got a lovely hacking cough. But it was before testing, so we're not entirely sure. But I was hallucinating quite badly during this thing. And my daughter had just done the Black Death in the Middle Ages in her history project. And we'd done a homework about remedies for the Black Death, which included 10-year-old treacle, which apparently there is actually now scientific evidence that there's interesting bacterium and everything else in there that might work. And the other one was shaving a chicken's bottom and sticking it under your armpit. And I vividly remember trying to get to the chicken farm behind our house because I was convinced if only I could get hold of a chicken, shave its bottom and stick it under my armpit, I'd get better, and it was fine. Yeah. And being very angry that the sell-by date on my treacle meant that it wasn't going to work. Yeah. So it was a very weird time, but it's led to some positive things.
And did you try that? Did you actually try it, though, sell-by date, expired or otherwise?
I did. I ate a large amount of treacle. I also cut off all my hair with a pair of nail scissors, but I don't remember doing that bit. But in a way, it was a positive thing because it's made me follow this dream that I've always had of running away and going to art college, which I've never been brave enough to do. But I've finally, at the age of 44, managed to to go and do, which is very weird because all the other people on my course are about 16 to 18. So I'm trying not to be a mother hen.
But, isn't that the thing, though? Because, I mean, it's when you, when obviously people, you've had COVID or you've, you know, and we all know people who've had it, and in some cases, family members who died because of it. And, but at the same time, it's one of those sort of things you think, well, how do we respond to this? And I found it very hard to break out of my customary routine, like not being able to go to work, being on campus on the 23rd of March and having all these signs everywhere saying the Gulbenkian is closed until further notice. And of course it was like, best part of 6 months before everything reopened. But somehow it also did allow, as you say, new challenges, new possibilities, because I think a lot of people thought, we're not going to let this defeat us. We're not going to, we can't, the virus is horrible and it's ruining people's lives, but it doesn't have to define us completely.
Yeah. Well, I think in our case, I was very, very determined that lockdown was not going to be something miserable. We were going to make lots of very positive memories. So one of the things that we did was we started doing Friday night suppers, which is from the old Jewish idea. And I'm sort of Jewish-ish-ish. And every Friday, we now sit down and we'll do some bonkers themed supper. So I'm trying at the minute to decide whether we're going to do an election themed supper tomorrow night or whether we're going to do a sort of Guy Fawkes revolutionary themed supper tomorrow night. But we were doing things like, we did a 1970s fondue night, and we did a Tudor dinner party, and we tried really hard, or at least I tried really hard, to make sure that when the kids look back on this period, the majority of their memories are going to be positive ones, where we all came together as a family and we did bonkers but brilliant things that made us happy and reinforced our family bonds.
And it's really funny with children, because I found that with my own, that they are very aware of the virus, but for them, they weren't saying, as they used to before March, oh, can we go to, I don't know, McDonald's? Or they knew that they couldn't go to play areas because the play areas were closed, but they were happy to stay in the house. It's the adults who sometimes have the itchy feet. The children were happy to go out, but they were also aware, and they understood the parameters of everything. They weren't going to school, but they were happy and excited, at least at the beginning, to be taught at home. So in a funny way, the children set an example, actually, to adults, to say it's possible, because they were brimming with enthusiasm. They weren't sitting there thinking, oh, I can't play with my friends. You know, to have like a five-year-old child on a Zoom call with a friend in school, you know, I didn't know what Zoom was until 6 months ago. And then, you know, my own children are sort of knowing how to use the technology. So as you say, it's been a very mixed year.
Yeah, well, certainly my children were very much better at following the rules than my parents were. And I don't know whether that's a generational thing or because they're better at using tech or what, but also I think my son's got autism and he found it extremely hard. He can quote you chapter and verse and he can tell you what the R number is pretty much everywhere locally. He can tell you what the CDC guidelines are, and he was very frightened about leaving the house. In fact, it took 3 months before we could actually get him to literally just leave the building and go into the garden, which was very worrying. But certainly they were a lot better at following the guidelines than my parents.
Yeah, and some people, I mean, my parents were because they're well over 70, they followed the advice and they were shielding, and kind of by choice in the end, because it was clear that they didn't have to do that. But you also had records and, you know, people that they know who were in their mid-80s who were going to the supermarket every day. And I think they were thinking, how can that be? So, as you say, it's sort of people, I think, responded in very sort of diverse ways. But somehow, I think it's allowed that recalibration. Perfect. If we're talking about nostalgia, so we've got lots to go on to in a minute, but that sort of recalibration, because it makes people think, okay, I can't do things in the normal way, so what do I want to do? If you can't go to work in the normal way, you therefore say, well, what is it that I really want to do? And like with you, I mean, the art college, I mean, would you have imagined 6 months ago that you'd have embarked on that course?
No, I'd never have been brave enough. And I think if I hadn't been so ill, and I really was frighteningly ill to the point where, I was gaga. And if I hadn't been that ill, I wouldn't have been brave enough to do it. But it's something I've always really, really wanted to do. So in a way, I'm grateful. But in a way, I don't know, I wish it hadn't happened, because I know it's put an enormous stress on so many people, and people have lost loved ones. And that, and I hate having, you know, been working in a school. I hate seeing how much it's affected children's mental health in particular. And I find that very worrying. And I think that's going to be the long ongoing problem that we're going to have to unpack and sort out, because I think this has damaged people's mental health quite badly.
And do you want to say something, Penny, about your work? Because I know that nostalgia comes into it, but do you want to say a little bit about what it is that you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was thinking about this last night, and my entire life revolves around nostalgia, I think. My grandma had this theory. She's Welsh, and she had this theory that in every Welsh family, there had to be a bard who remembered the family history to pass it on to the next generation. And she was very much the bard in her generation, and she decided it was my job to remember it for everybody else. So from the minute I can remember, I was grilled with family history. And when we went on walks, it was like, this is where so-and-so died. This is where such-and-such met his wife. This is where your great-grandfather jumped out of a window after bonking the vicar's maid, that sort of thing. So it was kind of inevitable that I'd end up doing something like archaeology for a living. And I'm not one of the people who's like Indiana Jones or sort of up to my neck in mud. I decided very early on that that was not going to be my thing. But I take the archaeological finds and then I interpret them for different audiences. So back in my early 20s, I worked for a museum consultancy and I travelled all over the world where I would sort of be given a job. They say, look, what do we do with this site or what do we do with this building? And it would be my job to go and find out as much as possible about that particular place or thing and then try and work out a plan for how it could be presented to the public and make money.
Yeah.
And it was great fun. I got to go to places like Albania, where I got kidnapped, and South Africa and all sorts of places. And sometimes I sort of come out with these stories because something will be in the news or trigger it off and I'll tell it to my children. They're like, nah, you never did that. I was like, yeah, I did. Because everybody sees this nice little fluffy mum. And but actually it was quite exciting, and I got to see lots and lots of heritage. And then when I had the kids, I moved into teaching, because that's another great love of mine. And I sort of balanced that with working with people like Christchurch and the cathedral and other museums and places. And again, it's taking the heritage and translating it, and it's now predominantly for a school audience because of my teacher training background. And it's great fun. So I've gotten to run around doing bows and arrows and setting fire to things whilst teaching children about the Stone Age, or I get to sort of do bizarre things about medieval animals, or it's really good. It's lovely. I'm very, very lucky. And I get to wallow in heritage and nostalgia.
Yeah. And the Welsh background is interesting because obviously that's my background. And I had a grandfather who his whole life said, he actually was from Worcester, from England, but he moved to Cardiff in his early 20s. And he always said, when I was growing up, he'd always regale us with these amazing stories from the Second World War and onwards. And he always would say, I'll write my memoirs one day. And he always said it, and he always said it. But in his late 80s, he did. Mm. And then I think it kept him going until he died at the age of 95. Yeah. He would get up every morning and he would write a certain amount on his, he didn't have a computer, but he had an electronic typewriter, and he'd be tip-axing any of the words that he didn't mean to say. And he would do it so fluidly. And it was only actually at his funeral when I suddenly realized, I was reading excerpts from his memoirs, that I suddenly thought, this was well before I did all my nostalgia interviews and so on. And I thought, but rather than wait till I'm in my late 80s, I'm sort of like doing it now. Yeah. But he gave me that inspiration. He was the catalyst. Yeah. So what you said there is really interesting. So it's that sense of needing to communicate, and whether it's done orally or whether it's, as I do through diaries, to write things down. But have you always had that sort of that impulse?
Well, in a way, though, it's been a bit of a burden. I think certainly our family defines itself by its myths and histories and things a little bit too much, to the point where I almost felt like I had to be a certain way because of the family background. And I used to worry, my father's family is interesting, is the politest way of putting it. And I used to worry, oh God, what if that's going to be an inherited characteristic? What if my son turns out like that, or my daughter turns out like that? And it used to almost be overwhelming. And I didn't know whether the clinging on to the family heritage was because we were a bit rootless when I was growing up. We moved to Bermuda and then we moved to Surrey and everything else. But home was always the Quantox in Somerset, because that was where, you know, we could trace our ancestry back, you know, really far. And we felt like, you know, our bones were almost in the ground there. But it's only recently, really, that I've started thinking I've got to let go of that sort of mythology, and because it's almost suffocating, and it stops you, or it stopped me from being brave and sort of being an individual, because I constantly wanted to be like so-and-so, or I was frightened of being like such-and-such. And I kind of, I'm wary about passing that down to my children. But again, I'm also very keen to pass on the heritage. I just don't want it to be suffocating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in terms of your background, What about earliest memories? I mean, indeed, where and when were you born?
I was born in Bristol, and my earliest memory is probably picking forget-me-nots on a step outside my mum and dad's house, watching my brother make mud pies and my mum playing the piano. But there's also this other memory, which my mother's convinced didn't happen, but I think it's my earliest memory. And it's when I had wet hair. My brother had just been born, so I must have been about 18 months old, and I was put to bed with wet hair. And I must have been told something like, if you go to bed with wet hair, you'll die of pneumonia. And I remember that lying there with wet hair, crying and crying, thinking that my parents wanted to let me die of pneumonia because of this new baby. Yeah. And all he did was scream and shriek. And what was the point of keeping him when I was much nicer? But my mother swears that would never have happened. She would never have done that to me. But yeah, that feels like my first memory. But then first memories are very complex things. There's a book called England, England by Julian Barnes. And there's basically a quote that your first memory is your first artfully, innocently arranged lie. And that's how I kind of feel about memory. I do think it's an artful lie, maybe based on some sort of truth, but composed in such a way that it fits your personal narrative.
Yeah, and on a superficial level, I can agree with that. You know, and it can be an example of a film. And I thought, oh, I really enjoyed that film when I saw it at the cinema. And you read the diary, and it was like, oh, it was a bit rubbish. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
Like all these like subsequent layers of meaning that you've imposed, reimposed on that original event. But seriously, you know, that you're right, because there are composite memories, that there are things you remember days at school, but you remember. You imagine things happening all like one archetypal day, but of course it's like a mishmash of various events. But there is something about diary. I don't know if you've ever kept a diary.
I've always tried, and every so often I'll manage it for, say, 6 months or something. I found one the other day, which I wrote when I was 15, and it was amazing because there are all these enormous events going on, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and everything else happening. And there's me agonising about, does so-and-so fancy me? Or why am I so tired all the time? Oh, I hate my GCSEs, etc. And I'm thinking, it's a little bit myopic. So.
Absolutely not, because I was talking to Mark Connolly. I think we both know Mark, who I interviewed a couple of years ago, and he kind of was the inspiration for this, because he was saying that looking at the diaries of, and he was saying, you know, let's look at the First World War. We know what the generals, we know what the politicians were doing, because that's well documented. There are records, Hansard proceedings, everything. But what about, and he gave the example of a housewife in a mill town in Lancashire. He said, what was she doing on that day? What were the things that mattered to her? And in that sense, obviously her record probably was more to do, you know, may not have been about all the great sort of world events. I mean, in the same way, this is the backdrop of the virus. We have the backdrop of American election. As we speak, we don't know. It looks like Biden is going to win. But by the time this interview goes out, we could have a completely different sort of outcome. And in a way, it's a slice of life. And it's very easy to imagine that, although there are key moments, like people will talk before our lifetime, but people will talk about the death of JFK, or I can barely remember the death of John Lennon, but you know, that for some, or of course the death of Diana, but of course there are lots of other things going on, like the children being ill, or about an exam that you've got coming up, or something which might seem quite myopic or pedestrian, but it isn't at the age of 15. It's your world.
I mean, that's the thing. If you ask my daughter what happened this week, it won't be the lockdown or the fact that it's the American election. It'll be the fact that she had to put her cap down. And that's the overwhelming emotion. She doesn't really care about the rest of it. I do worry sometimes, because people are going to rely in the future on Facebook for mining people's memories and impressions of the time. And I do worry about how Facebook people put on a good shop front. And so, I mean, sometimes when I look through the memories that they flash up to you on Facebook, you think, my God, I had an idyllic life. But then I remember, actually, that day, it looks picture perfect. But on the other hand, the cat had vomited all over the place, or, you know, so-and-so had had a row with his sister. And, it, you know, so it's interesting. I think mining nostalgia is a very difficult and dangerous thing. And you have to go into it knowing that there's a certain amount of fake news.
That's a really good way of putting it. And I think the fact that I've always kept a diary kind of acts as a check, well, not checkpoint, what's the word I'm looking, as a corrective against that kind of excess. But it's interesting to juxtapose the way, I suppose events take on a different significance in terms of age and experience, and also just the way that we are it may be resilience, but just the way that we're able to acclimatize to particular things.
Stockholm syndrome.
Well, exactly. And it's really funny how the part, you know, sometimes we think, oh, I'm never going to do that again. Or Christmas is a good example. People say, oh, I there's no way I'm having that Christmas dinner. There's no way I'm going to invite so-and-so around. And of course, 12 months later, everyone repeats it because everyone's looking for that perfect Christmas and they know they're never going to get it, but we still go through the same rituals, even though it never works out as we planned. So, I wonder if we all go through life in the same way. We could have known things are good for us and things are bad for us, but we're also good at kind of trying to make up for the sins of the past.
Yes. Was it the Oscar Wilde quote, the triumph of hope over experience?
Yeah. And sometimes, of course, as we know from what's going on in America, sometimes you think the past is being to some extent you're thinking it's like, do people not learn from what's happened before?
Yeah.
But glutton for punishment and all that. But what about, so you mentioned some earliest memories. What about things that you enjoyed doing as a child? I mean, it might have been music or film or play or poems or going to school.
I'm very lucky being, I mean, we moved to Bermuda when I was about two, and I was so lucky being brought up there. And my memories at that point, I mean, they are rosy, golden memories, which probably bears nothing to the truth, because my mum's diaries from that period are, I hate being here, it's so miserable, blah, 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 blah. But I had a lovely time. We spent the whole time running around beaches and boats and swimming, and I was in the water the whole time, and it was just idyllic. But we were always pining for this weird idea of Britain, and which was, I don't know, it was a composite of Ladybird books and Bedknobs and Broomsticks. That's what we thought Britain was. And it was a bit of a rude shock when we moved back here when I was nine. It was like, oh, it's not like that. Nobody has a nanny and, things like that. And but I mean, swimming was my big thing. I was desperate to be a marine biologist because I just loved being in the water. And apparently I spent most of my swimming lessons scaring the life out of people, because if you're going to be in the water, you may as well be completely submerged, in my view. And I would spend the entire time at the bottom of the pool or at the bottom of the beach, which was great fun.
And do you look back then on, have you been back to Bermuda for a start?
Bermuda a couple of times. The last time I went back was 20 years ago though. And I've had a couple of opportunities to go back, but I know it's changed an awful lot. And part of me doesn't want to go back because I don't want to confront the fact that, it would sort of damage my memories. I don't want to really see what it is like now, because I don't want to see the fact that they've built on it. So all the beautiful green areas are now covered in little white houses. And I don't want to have to confront the reality of Bermuda now. When I really love my Bermuda circa 1983.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that about alumni events at university, maybe I dealt with that by immersing myself thoroughly into alumni activities at my alma mater. But for years, I couldn't go back because there were good memories, but also bad memories. And also it was that sense of going back and feeling that there are, I mean, and just as in life, but I was in a very small Welsh town for over a decade. And you always see the same people every day. And there was, I think I needed to branch out. I needed to see a different part of the world. And I look back now and think, gosh, if only I'd left sooner. I had a lovely time and got some wonderful degrees. And it was all, in that sense, no regrets. But I think there was also the better the devil you know scenario. And I think that can also be very bad, because you if you don't know what else you can do in the world, and you say, well, I'll stick to the thing that I'm doing here, you can easily look back and think, right, maybe I wasn't adventurous enough. And I think going back felt like a regressive step. It doesn't feel like that now, because enough time, several decades have passed. But at the time, a few, 10, 20 years ago, it felt like it would be a regressive step.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. And how did you feel? Because I remember going to Hawaii once, and you're expecting paradise. So in your case, ironically, it was the reverse. It was going to England and, expecting to see this. But you were expecting to see this England that was Enid. Sounds like you were expecting an Enid Blyton version of England.
Yeah, pretty much. Although, funny enough, Enid Blyton was banned in Bermuda, so I didn't read those until my 30s. They considered it too racist. I can't remember why they banned it, but we had books like Little Black Sambo in the one library on the island, but you couldn't get Enid Blyton books or The Wizard of Oz because they were too dangerous in some scheme. But when I came back, we did expect it to be like something from the Ladybird books, Janet and John and Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And it was horrible because instead of it being beautiful little thatched cottages that I'd expected, suddenly we were in nasty 1970s concrete things. Yeah. And it was so grey. I felt like I was suffocating the whole time because I wasn't used to cloud cover over everything. And people were horrible about our accent. I had to change. I had a Bermudian accent. I had to have elocution lessons and deportment lessons because I was a heathen from the colonies. And everything that I had thought England was turned out to be an absolute massive lie. Mm. And the one thing that didn't, turn out to be a disappointment was my grandmother. I clung very much to her because at least she was the same and hadn't changed. But I found England a horrible place. And we moved to Surrey, which was heart of the commuter belt and very, very greedy and status driven. And it was just bewildering and I hated it. So I think I escaped when I was 18 and I was very glad and I would not look back. So my memories of Surrey were just hideous. It was all one-upmanship. Who's got the biggest car? Who's got the poshest mm-hmm. house and the flashiest wardrobe? And I hated it.
Yeah. And I find that dealing with other people's apprehensions of a place is interesting, because going to Lampeter as I did as a student, I was dealing with people who were predominantly, I don't know if the statistic was true, but certainly anecdotally, it seemed to be that 50% of the students in Lampeter were from London and the South East. And I agree, they were all from Surrey or Sussex or Kent, indeed, the very part of the world where we are now. London, certainly, Essex. So it did feel that there were also different life experiences. But whereas a lot of people went westwards for a different kind of life, I also went westwards, but I went from the city of Cardiff. So it's really funny how you've got these different layers of experiences, because you go to a place, but the people define the place. But when the place is full of people who are non-indigenous to that place, it gives you a very and temporal, because they then leave. So after 2 or 3 years, they leave and they go back to Surrey or Sussex or whatever. So your sense of place is mixed up with other people's memories and their nostalgic sort of sense of where they've come from. But how did you work all of that out? Because is there a sense in which you then sort of in later life were able to say, having had those different experiences, that did it give you a very clear sense about the sort of life you wanted to live in terms of villages, towns, cities, locations? Or did you just sort of find your own niche? Did you create your own identity almost, rather than being beholden to those horrible ones from the 70s and 80s?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I had a very strong idea of what I wanted, which was to go and travel the world and be very exciting and do lots of different things. And I liked being the outsider. So as soon as I possibly could, and I left Surrey, I went to St. Andrews and then traveled all over the place, lived in America for a bit, lived in London for a bit, went back to Bermuda. I tried to travel as much as possible because I rather liked being the glamorous outsider, particularly places where the English accent was seen to have a certain cachet for being, intellectual and sophisticated. And it was great fun. And to be honest, I probably would have kept that going had it not been for meeting my husband and ending up in Kent, which I was horrified about, actually. I remember vividly the day that he told me. I was sitting at a pub with my mother, and Simon said, "I've got a job in Kent." I said, "Yes, but you've been offered one, and you're going for a job interview in Glasgow. Couldn't we live in Glasgow instead? Can you not wait until you've had the interview there?" He went, no, it's a job in the hand. We've got to go with that. I was like, but I don't want to live in Kent, because I thought it was going to be Surrey light. So I was I found that very, very hard. And also I hadn't quite realised how being a mother and a wife was going to curtail my travel things, because he earned the money. So we followed his job and I ended up doing odd jobs around to support him and the kids. And there was a great deal of frustration and bitterness, I think, looking back on it on my part. And I've tried really hard to carve out something that was tolerable. And now we do live in a nice little village. And it is very much sort of, I wouldn't say it's Enid Blyton, it's more Midsummer Murders, but it's definitely that cutesy English experience that I think if you lived in America you would automatically think was, on brand. But
Well, and of course, I've been to your village because, of course, you're heavily in every year in late January, of course, because of Panto. Yeah. And I've been, is it the last two or even three? I think I can't remember that I've been to, and absolutely blown away because I've been to the official professional ones, like at the Marlowe Theatre. And I've been to yours, and I'm not, and I'm serious about this. You wrote the script. I mean, there was something, and it was also a really polished performance in terms of the lighting and not the cinematography, but you know what I mean, the production design and the acting and the humour, and obviously Simon plays the pantomime dame. But I have to say that was phenomenal. I was blown away at how, and also in that sense, you can live in a small village, but you can do something that you put your stamp on it. And it sounds like that's the difference when you grow up and you're just doing what the adults tell you and you sort of don't, you know, your identity is submerged. But it sounds like you've really owned that and what you do. I mean, it's legendary. You know, people come from far away, don't they, to see your pantos every year.
Yeah, well, we're really lucky. Matt, the guy who does the lighting design, he actually works for professional theatres in the West End, and he's extremely talented. So, I mean, we really lucked out having him move to the village. And, you know, personally, I think of it a bit like care in the community of Panto Group, because it keeps a group of reprobates off the streets for 6 months while we're rehearsing. But it's really good fun. But I have worked very hard, and actually I hadn't realised it until just talking to you now, that I have constructed the England that I thought I was going back to when I moved here from Bermuda. I have constructed that England for myself here with the house and the panto and the children and the being married to a professor and everything else. I've worked really hard, and I hadn't realised that until you just brought it up, to make the life I thought I was going to have when I was nine. So interesting, actually. I hadn't realised that.
But it's as though, I mean, I suppose I'm doing the same kind of thing, because on one level I'm coming into an office every day and I'm sort of, you know, it's the same sort of routine. I go to the cinema, but of course it's what you do with that, because there are transitory experiences. There are things that, you know, I mean, maybe that there's a mixture of not guilt, but I suppose if I'm going to go to the cinema all the time, then there has to be something. It can't just be the sort of scenario. This is my worst nightmare, when somebody would say, "Have you seen so-and-so?" And you then have to think about it and you say, "Oh yeah, I did see it, but I can't remember anything about it." Well, what's the point then, if you're just going to do all of these things and it just flitters away? So I try to concretize experiences. So that also gives me the ammunition to do it. Like, I have to write my review. So it sort of goes together. But it's like my own spin on it. It wouldn't work for anybody else necessarily, but it's also galvanizing rather than just sort of going through the motions. But it sounds like you've done the same with Panto.
Yeah, well, I think it was that awful phrase, go big or go home. And I think, that's something I've learned the hard way. But it's much better to throw yourselves into things. I remember there was a story that we were told in chapel when I was at school, when I first came back from Bermuda. And it was about this old guy in the woods, and he's got a terrible singing voice, but he's singing a hymn of praise to God, and isn't the world a wonderful thing? And these two young novices turn up, and they have beautiful singing voices. And there's no. What you need to do is you need to sing it like this. And but God loved the old man singing, because even though it was rubbish, he threw his heart and soul into it. Whereas the two young men, they had beautiful voices, but they didn't care about it passionately, and they were doing it by rote. And that always stuck in my head, that if you're going to do something, do it with as much oomph as you can manage, because then even if you fall on your face, at least you can say, "I tried."
And you write the script, is that right, each year? You write
Yeah, there's sort of a running joke. I started writing the script. I'd been diagnosed with vertigo about 8.5 years ago. I don't know what it was. They don't think it was vertigo now, but basically it was the same impact. I couldn't walk upright properly. I had to be helped to drink cups of tea and things. And I was on socking great amounts of drugs to try and help me stabilise. And a friend of mine said, "Well, look, you're stuck at home all day. Why didn't you try writing the panto script?" Because very sadly, the chap who had written the previous three had passed on. And I thought, well, I've got nothing else to do. And but it's mostly drug fueled, we joke. But it's great fun. And I love giving old fairy tales a new twist. And so we've done feminist versions of Cinderella, and we've done, weird and wonderful ones. And the one that I had written for this year during lockdown, which sadly we can't perform, there was a lot of stuff about being stuck in quarantine. And we had characters which were very obviously Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings. And it's nice because you throw in sort of topical references and cultural references to things that are relevance at the minute, but at the same time, you're using this very simple blueprint, which is, I think, one of the reasons why Panto is so successful, because you've got these very nice blueprints, but then you can tack on anything else you want to make them relevant and fun for today.
Yeah, no, that was very much my sense, because I always, until I had children, going to the pantomime was never an option. I've actually been on my own in recent years, because I think it is a family show, but also there is something so cutting edge about it sometimes, that it's, as you say, it's the old formula, but with a new twist, and they're phenomenally good. And also, it's like, well, you know, when I was at university, I used to watch Spitting Image every week, because I know it's back.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of thing. It's that topic. It's being critical. It's very. It doesn't have to be English, but it could be a very sort of idiosyncratic and English element, certainly to pantomime.
Yeah.
And that's something which I think translates really well, because you've got. It's like a perfect film as well. You've got all the ingredients in it, but you've got the musical, you've got the bawdy stuff, you've got the sight jokes, but you've also got, as you say, the twist, the feminist twist, or you've got something which is actually quite clever, quite political, it's quite sharp, and bringing it all together into one. So it's like you've got the children. So a lot of that stuff will go over the children's heads, perhaps, but it accommodates everybody at the same time. Now, that is a real skill. So although film is more my thing, I have to say, going to the pantomime and seeing the live show and see how it plays out and the way you interact with the crowd, the audience, I think actually that you must feel so gratified writing the thing and then seeing its execution night after night in January.
When I do write the thing, I write it in my head with limitless budget and people like Judi Dench and Ian McKellen in it, and then it sort of, it's very hard. I get terribly nervous waiting to see what the first read through is going to be like, and I don't cast the characters, so that's very much left up to the director and the producer, and so it's very tricky, because I have clear views about how I want everything to work and so I have to take a step back and just sort of bite my tongue. But on the night, it's so stressful, because I'm usually juggling a husband in a dress who's sort of packed in with several thousand layers of underpinning to hold everything up and in. I've got two children, I'm juggling hysterical, you know, people in the cast and ballet dancers and everything else backstage. So really, I'm numb about the whole thing until we get the DVD back. And then even then, I look back at it and I go, oh my God, I shouldn't have put that in, or I should put that in, or maybe I should have gotten rid of that scene. And I think it's really hard for me. I think I find it very difficult. I prefer thinking about it in my head, and then everything else, I just let everybody else take over and let them get on with it, because they do a much better job. I'd angst over it far too much. So,
but there's something about a live performance, though, because I find it with my students, because I can, you know, you can write inverted commas the perfect lecture. I mean, that I have not done that, but you write the perfect. But there's the lecture in the head. The one that reads well, because whenever you start, if you've never lectured before, you always write too much, or you don't have to balance it, and you've got an hour's lecture, so you've got so much material that you're cramming it in. And then, of course, the key thing is it doesn't play out in the room, and you're thinking, but I've been at conferences where people have said things like, I thought I had an hour, but I've only got half an hour, so therefore I'll just read really quickly, and they weren't joking, and then you've got this impossible thing, and they say, I haven't got time to explain it, I'll just carry on, and you just think, oh, this is awful. It may be really good to read, and I'd like to read it, but listening to you deliver it is just a waste of time. So I do think that there is something, and it's taken me many years to get to this point, but I now really enjoy seminars more than and even online with all the breakout groups and all the chances afforded, because with a lecture, sometimes, you know, you're presenting material, but you don't know if it's all resonating with everyone. The interactive sessions, which is the closest to pantomime in that sense of having a dialogue, seeing how the audience respond, and actually ensuring that they go out with a smile on their face, and that is so gratifying. So, you know, you must have had that kind of experience when running your show.
I'm so thrilled that you like it so much, actually, and I do it because it's something that my family and I do together. And it's one of the few things that my family and I all do together that we all love. And you know, seeing everybody laughing and smiling and going out happy is brilliant. And also, I mean, what's fun is sometimes I've written a character in my head and it'll be given to a member of the cast, and they'll do something completely different with it. They'll completely flip it in their interpretation. And that's fantastic. And I love it, seeing somebody else's point of view on that character that I, you know, it's really interesting to see people's different interpretations. I suppose it's like nostalgia, isn't it? You can have 50 people in the room having the same event and they'll all remember it in a different way or interpret it in a different way. And it's nice to see with pantomime how different people pick up different things that maybe I didn't even notice were funny, but then other people will sort of interpret it as being absolutely hysterical because of the way some actor has put a twist on it or whatever.
But that's the thing, like with back to what we're saying about diaries, because if everybody writes their own review, and of course the thing about Facebook, and I'm relatively new to Facebook, I mean, I use it all the time, but I've only been doing it for about 3 years. But of course, everyone puts their, I mean, obviously people are good, and it's because they're being truthful. They all thought the pantomime was amazing. But you get a snapshot of people's view, and I think that is so important. It's like in films where you know you've got the or based on old musicals or something, where you've got the stage show and then they're waiting for the New York Times critic the next day to give it the review, and that I think is interesting because it's like, well, what how does it play out on Facebook? You get an immediate reaction, but it must mean something. I mean, if you've got 50 people in the room or whatever it is and they all write a review, in years to come, that's going to really mean something, because some of them will say things that you thought, you know, was this the same show? Others will say things that you were hoping that they'd say. Sometimes you might think, I don't recognize this at all. And I guess it's the same with a lecture, it's anything. And that's why I enjoy writing my film reviews, because they're invitations for dialogue. And actually, this brings us on to Rebecca the Hitchcock and Daphne du Maurier work, because we were talking, weren't we, over social media about Mrs. Danvers, and I was thinking I was actually quite serious that that would make it, she would make a great panto villain, but do you want to say a bit about that, because I think you played Mrs. Danvers when you were young, but there is something about that sort of quality which is timeless.
Well, we were doing drama exams, and I had to play two different parts. I was Madame Arcati, who is again one of my heroes, and Mrs. Danvers, and we got very into it. She's just wonderful, isn't she? But it's the whole premise of Rebecca, the book, and Hitchcock's film, is sort of memory and how it twists around you, and you know, jealousy and everything. It's terribly, terribly clever. I got very cross with the latest Netflix one because I just thought it turned it into a Mills and Boone pastiche, which was possibly accentuated by the fact that I was watching it for my art course. We were studying the Unheimlich, the uncanny. And they told us to go off and watch various different films. And so I watched the Hitchcock one the day before, and then I watched the Netflix version of Rebecca the day after, and it was like, oh, dear God, no. Mm-hmm. But I think Mrs. Danvers is tremendous, but the way she sort of almost turns Rebecca into a saint, and she twists those memories and deliberately selects and curates the memories so that she can be used as a weapon against the next Mrs. de Winter. Mm-hmm. It's very, very clever.
Yeah, and it felt, as you say, because I saw the good way of putting it, the Mills and Boons version of recent times, the Netflix one. But I did think that there was something in there which says something about contemporary. You know, it sheds a lot of contemporary light on contemporary things like gaslighting or stalking or whatever it might be. And I really got a lot out of that. It is going to. I've got my long list of things I've yet to read, but I will read Daphne du Maurier. So I think the plus with that is that I was a bit disappointed with it, but not knowing the original outside of having watched the Hitchcock film many years ago, that's giving me the impetus. But she should make a good panto villain.
Well, I remember reading it when I was 11 and I was doing the play, and I couldn't understand why the next Mrs. de Winter didn't just shove Max off a cliff or something, because I think she was well shot of both of them, because both Max de Winter and Mrs. Danvers are just such horrible creatures. And I know there's been a couple of people who've written prequels to Rebecca, where they sort of write it from Rebecca's perspective. And you know, because Max does lie and he is very duplicitous and he deliberately twists the history to fit. And so was she as bad as Max says, or is Mrs. Danvers correct in saying that she was this fantastic, fierce feminist creature? And so sort of looking back on that, particularly now that I'm a woman of a certain age, I do wonder how true the book is. It's lovely. You can unpack it at so many different levels. Traditional Cinderella story right the way up to sort of, you know, gaslighting horror. Yeah. And Daphne du Maurier is so clever. So I thoroughly recommend reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. I will certainly do that. And just before we move on to some more philosophically based questions before we start to wrap up, what about other things? I mean, we've covered so much ground already, but, you know, whether it's radio, TV, film, music, religion, sport, anything from maybe university that kind of sums up that particular part of your life?
Oh, university, that's just, I look back on that with horror. I was at St Andrews, which is a beautiful place, and I was very lucky that I had some very, very good friends, but I'm afraid my hormones went a bit bonkers. And yes, I'd been sort of, this is another thing about that heritage idea. My grandmother had ingrained upon me the idea of true love and how you had to hold on to it. And we'd been given all these true love stories in my family history. And so my first boyfriend at university, I thought was going to be the great love of my life. And I put up with an awful lot of nonsense before finally, luckily, he did something so unspeakably awful that I was able to sort of walk away from it. But I look back on that and I think, oh my goodness, what a waste. And I'm sure it was a very good learning curve and I learned some very valuable lessons from it. But I just feel appalled and hope my daughter and my son never take that turn.
Yeah. And also, I think when you meet somebody, and there are positives in this as well as negatives, but sometimes you meet someone and you think, oh, could this be the person I spend the rest of my life with? And that becomes the goal. And of course, if you're not on the same page as the other person, then that can, and also if you're 18, you look back and think how ridiculous. But how do you know when you have met the right person in the sense that you don't want to miss the boat on that one, that in that sense?
Well, funnily enough, the night before I met Simon, I was staying with my sister in Lancaster where I was doing up her house for her. And I had this terrible nightmare that I was going to meet the man I was going to marry the next day. And it was such an awful nightmare. I punched myself in the nose and I woke myself up covered in blood. And I remember the next day I was getting on the train to go down to Bristol to meet my new flatmate, who was Simon. Who was a friend of a friend, and the three of us were all going to go and join into this flat share together. And I remember it was such a vivid dream that every bloke I met on the way down from Lancaster to Bristol, I kept thinking, is it him? Is it him? Yeah. And then I remember meeting Simon for the first time and he had sandals on, which is a thing I really don't fancy. And he has a little bald patch. And I thought, thank God it's not him. It certainly won't be him. And it was, but it turned out to be him. Yeah. Because, and funnily enough, my grandmother decided, because she lived in Bristol, and I invited, a couple of weeks into it, I invited Simon and my flatmate, Demelza, to come and meet my grandma, who lived around the corner, for dinner. And she decided that I was going to marry Simon. She and my father both decided the first time they met him that he was the man I was going to marry. And they worked tirelessly, as did some of my friends, because they decided that he was like my grandpa. My grandma decided that Simon was so like my grandpa, not just to look at, but also personality-wise and, you know, his academic interests and things. And a couple of my other friends decided that because Simon was so nice, he would be such a nice change from my previous boyfriends, because I did have a disastrous dating record. So grandma, my dad and my friends worked tirelessly to ensure that Simon and I got together, which was exhausting at times because I dumped him regularly. But then they would work me round and I'm all right then.
But it's funny, isn't it? When you, because obviously you've been together for decades, even
20 years now.
Yeah. But when you then look back, I guess it all falls into place now. But it's funny that the journey there could never have been anticipated, because I suppose in the myth, in the Cinderella type thing, you know, you meet the prince of your dreams, and it's all, you know. But of course, the road there is never straightforward, and it's funny the way, you know, you meet people sometimes, and you say, how did you get to know each other? And you hear their story, and you're thinking, oh my word, the horror, but people persevere, and all sorts of quirky and unanticipated comings, synchronicities will work out.
Well, I certainly never expected to marry somebody from the Midlands, because prior to running away to become a teacher in Bristol, I worked on a project in Sandwell in the Midlands, which is literally around the corner from Simon's parents, where he grew up. And it was a horrendous, horrendous project. Basically, it was a beautiful old house that had been in the family and since the Doomsday Book, in fact, probably beforehand, and then it'd been burnt down and rebuilt, and it'd been used as a dodge to get money from certain people. It was tax fraud and insurance fraud and things. And I'd ended up getting death threats. And I also had food poisoning while I'd been up there, and it had just been the most appalling job. And I decided I hated the Midlands and I was never, ever going to go up there. And ironically, of course, I marry somebody from there and I'm going up there three times a year minimum. But I still feel sick every time we drive past the Sandwell sign.
Well, and it's back to our previous point about places and memories and smells, or, you know, particular connotations that stop us from being able to move on in some cases. But just as we start to wrap up, Penny, what about the questions about memories being positive or negative? I mean, it sounds like you've answered that question already, really, but in terms of the different places where you've lived and the way you've reshaped your past, but would you say your memories are predominantly positive?
I think I've edited out the ones I don't like. I had hypnotherapy last year in a last desperate bid to try and get rid of the dizziness, which amazingly worked, actually. And one of the things was unpacking the unpleasant memories that I had sort of shoved under the carpet, as it were. I was so determined not to have unhappy memories that things I, really awful traumatic things that I hadn't really wanted to confront, had been left festering. And the hypnotherapy made me confront them for the first time in a long time. And silly things like when I first moved back from Bermuda, I went to this particular school where everything I did was wrong. And I was constantly apologizing. So I do still apologize an awful lot. And it was just down to the fact that literally if I saw a teacher, I knew I'd done something wrong. Or if I saw another girl, it was just quicker to apologize and be thumped. And I've stopped apologizing so much because I've sort of exercised those demons by confronting those memories head on and by tackling that trauma. It's not only stopped me from feeling apologetic all the time and putting myself down all the time, it's also helped with the dizziness to the point where I haven't really had a dizzy episode or sort of, you know, violently upsetting vertigo episode since I started the hypnotherapy, which is interesting. And I think it was literally, I buried the nasty memories, but I needed to tackle them. I needed to process them and get them out. Yeah. So I feel like they were sort of almost like a horrible infection that I've had brewing away in me. And now I've finally been able to cauterize them.
No, that's a good way of putting it, because sometimes it's like we have the antibodies for that there are different ways of dealing with something. You're confronting it, running away from it. I mean, for me, the worst thing that anybody can ever say when you're dealing with something horrible, it might be a bad relationship or whatever, is somebody says, oh, forget about it, move on. And you're like, well, that, you know, it's going to reemerge somewhere else in your dreams and your nightmares. So you have to have mechanisms. I mean, I find actually one creative way is writing. And also to maintain your voice, because if you ever feel that you've lost your voice in a particular situation or you feel you can't get a word in, then at least in the diary, that's your way of putting it in your own words, where nobody can then say, you're not allowed to say that. So there are saving graces, I think. And I think that's important. But would you say, though, that you can be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Looking at it from the other side of having dealt with it now, or not dealt with it, I think I'm still processing them, but no, I don't feel nostalgic towards them at all. It was horrible, but at least I can now look at them without feeling sick. Some of the doctors I've spoken to and some of the therapists, because the vertigo really was all consuming. I had to give up the PhD I was doing. I had to give up work. At one point I was unable to walk, you know, I couldn't drive at all. And many of the doctors and therapists and the hypnotherapists said, actually, you're so splintered because you're trying to keep everybody happy and you're trying to juggle so many plates, but you're also trying to bury all your feelings about how this is going and how you've been made to, you know, keep everybody else happy. That's what's causing the dizziness. It's just sort of one massive sort of screaming panic attack because, you know, you're so unhappy not confronting how you feel about things. And now that I have confronted them, at least I don't feel frightened of them. I can recognize them and go, okay, well, I don't like you. I did a drawing for my application for art college, which was a Greek chorus of all these negative memories. And I hadn't realized it until I did it, but it had my maths teacher in it from when I was 9 telling me how stupid I was. It had family members telling me I wasn't worthy. And it was great actually to have it personified on this piece of paper. And I hadn't recognized the fact that I had this Greek chorus of nasty memories in my head, which were just sort of, you know, the embodiment of all these people that put me down or made me feel bad. And once I had it on paper, I was able to look at them and go, no, sod off. Yeah. I don't need to listen to you anymore. And occasionally I get out of that piece of paper and I will just look at them and go, no, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And so in a way, that those nostalgic memories have been quite positive.
Yeah. And also it's that sense of control, being able to seize control of the narrative, I think. That if you put something in your own words, if you concretize it, the strength of that can give you, because you say, here it is, it's all in there, and it becomes something that, rather than this sense of having lots of different disparate sort of experiences, all that, you feel you're going mad. It's very much like the Daphne du Maurier story we were just talking about, but that sense sometimes of thinking, you know, my narrative and somebody else's narrative doesn't accord. But in having it all written down, it empowers, because you can say, this is what happened. And the fact that you've maybe written something, or you've, or as you said, you've confronted that bit of paper and said, I'm not going to let it define me. That is so cathartic.
Yes. Well, I kind of feel that, I mean, this year has sucked in many ways, but actually I feel like I have confronted my demons this year, and I have seized the narrative back again, because I think I was, it's funny, I was thinking about, we were talking about women in art the other day, my sister and I, she's an artist, and much of women's creative instincts have been sort of in the margins of things, like we'll do the quilts or we'll do the sort of samplers. So we'll take something that's utilitarian and then we'll make it prettier, or we'll make it more interesting. We've never had the right until quite recently to sort of say, no, I'm going to write the book, or I'm going to write, you know, I'm going to paint that big painting. And I think for much of my marriage, and it's certainly not Simon's fault, I think it's just the way things have panned out, because I have postnatal depression and all sorts of stuff, I think I've been sort of marginalizing myself. And this year I've decided to step center stage, jump in the middle of the page and say, no, this is my story now. I'm taking back control, rather than being at the periphery all the time.
And that reaps dividends, as you say, with all your many endeavors, not least, well, obviously the panto is the one that I see you do, but I think so, whatever you're doing, that recipe is working, so you've got that, and you've got the antidote, you've got the antibodies, so run with it. But what about fulfilling the dreams that you had when you were young? You know, if you were to have a conversation with your younger self, what would your younger self think about what you're doing now? Would they be surprised?
It depends what age you picked me at. When I was six, I won a painting competition. We had to do a portrait of somebody we loved and then why we loved them. And the portrait was of my mum. And my mum is the best person in the world. She can make jam tarts and babies. And as far as I was concerned, at age six, this was the highest achievement you could actually reach, you know, jam tarts and babies, in which case my six-year-old self would be deeply impressed that I can make cookies and jam, and I've had two children and I live in a nice house. I think 11-year-old me would probably be quite chuffed. I think me when I was 16 and wanting to be a radical ball-busting feminist would be absolutely appalled. And I would probably have to apologise to her enormously at this point. I'm really sorry I let the sun down. But
I suppose in the same way, what about keeping in touch with people from those different periods of your life? I mean, social media can do this, but are you in, I mean, maybe not going back to Bermuda, but, or maybe you do, but do you have those connections, those associations still?
Sort of. It was very difficult because we moved around such a lot. We didn't, it sounds awful, but friends were largely disposable because it was so difficult to keep in touch with them. I'm still in touch with my best friend from Bermuda. But we're both so very different. I mean, we were absolutely, you could have thought we were twins at one point, not physically, but we love the same thing. We love Cyndi Lauper and neon nets, bows and Tinkerbell nail polish. And now she's married to an evangelical pastor. And, she's very, very religious, whereas I have to say not. And she lives in Bermuda still. I live in England. So we're very different, but I have a few people I keep in touch with from school, but school was in England, certainly was a very unhappy time. And I think the people who I've stayed in touch with, I've stayed in touch with because we have shared trauma rather than necessarily we have anything else in common. It's just we sort of prop each other up because awful things happened at that place and we understand why we are the way we are. Yeah. But I have lots of friends from university still that I stay in touch with, though some of them dropped off when I had children because I suppose they didn't and they kept going with their professional lives and I became mum for a bit. And it's hard, actually. I mean, I don't know whether you found this, but when you have children, it's almost like you move to a different planet with some of your friends and you don't quite speak the same language anymore.
I mean, also you grow friends, or, you know, you meet the other parents at the nursery or the school gates, and often it can also make friendships work with people who maybe you are acquaintances of, but if they've got children as well, then suddenly you've got this thing in common, and all you ever do, you suddenly realize that whenever you meet up, all you're doing is talking about your respective children's experiences, and you think, but 5 years ago neither of us had children, so what did we talk about? Did we ever think to each other?
A friend of mine who I'm actually going to go for a walk with this morning, when we first met, it was through a baby group, and she looked at me, she went, isn't it awful how sometimes you hang out with people and the only thing you've got in common is about your children like each other? And you're suddenly forced to socialise these people. And it's great your kids get on, but they're not the sort of people that you'd necessarily want to be friends with.
Yeah.
So in a way, I value her friendship a lot more because our children don't see each other anymore, but we're still friends. So that means that we did have something in common.
It's the same analogy when you've got a sibling who has a boyfriend or girlfriend who you get on with really well. Then when their relationship breaks, you kind of feel disloyal. But you think, but you're my friend as well. But you know, you have to be very careful how you play.
Yeah, it was dreadful because I had terrible taste in men, but their mothers were usually lovely, and their mothers and I always really really got on very very well.
Yeah.
And it was quite hard when I split up with the boyfriends because sometimes the mums would want to stay in touch. I don't know whether it was in the hope that I might go back out with their son again or something, but it was really hard because I wanted to stay friends with the mother, but I wanted to have nothing to do with their son.
My very last question, Penny.
Yeah.
Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I used to be a looking back sort of person. Certainly career-wise, I look back a lot. But I am starting to look forward a lot more, particularly now since I started the art course. So I'm not hanging on to past triumphs and past adventures, because I was quite sad about saying goodbye. My life in London, when I worked, you know, all over the world and I was doing exciting things with museums, I'm responsible for the toilets in Stonehenge. That's my great contribution to humanity. Because they only had one at the time, and I told them off about this and said they needed to have more. I was constantly comparing myself with that person in my 20s, and now I've decided I've got to draw a line under that and start focusing on what's going to come and the adventures that are going to come, rather than being sad that I had to give up that life.
Yeah. Well, may the adventures continue. And it was so wonderful, Penny, to catch up with you this morning.
Thank you
for being my guest this week.
Well, it was lovely to catch up with you, and I send my love to you and the kids.